Fear is a powerful thing, which is why it's so often used, particularly by, you know, people in power to try to control us and, you know, get people to stay in line. And I think that's part of what the angels, you know, the messengers of God recognize, is that it's appropriate at a certain level and in a certain way to fear God.
Right.
The Bible also says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of understanding. But, you know, Jesus says that perfect love drives out fear. And so I think that the understanding that we can be, you know, in humility, we can submit ourselves to a way and to a person in Jesus who can demonstrate what love looks like in the middle of genuinely scary situations. I think that's what the journey of faith is about.
Welcome to the Unleash Generosity podcast, exploring the intersection of faith, service, philanthropy, and community. I'm your host, Aaron Scott. Thanks for tuning in for the second part of my conversation with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. You can listen to episode 9, part 1 of our conversation, on the Unleash Generosity website, which is unleashgenerosity.org, or on Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts. You can also listen to any of the other past episodes on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or on our website. You can also check us out on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. Before we jump into part 2, I'd like to briefly share a few little snippets of part 1 of the conversation to kind of set the stage and tie the first conversation that we had in part 1 into some of the things that we're going to talk about in part 2. So here's some of the highlights of part 1.
During the lockdowns, there was a lot of realignment, you know, how churches would continue to meet. Our community was part of creating this resource for prayer, you know, daily prayer in our homes together. It's called Common Prayer. It's a book, but it's really a community. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of people around the world who pray this together every day. A lot of folks who pray with us got in touch and said, you know, this is really becoming a lifeline. I was raised up in the Baptist Church, which was not just the center of our spiritual life, but also of community life. Those folks loved me well. You know, my Sunday school teachers made me memorize the Bible. We memorized it in the King James Version.
Mm-hmm.
It was good enough for Jesus. It was good enough for us. We weren't going to change anything. I grew up in that community at precisely the moment when hundreds of millions of dollars were invested in mobilizing our community and communities like ours for a right-wing political coalition, that I came to the sort of dead end of the religious right pretty early on. As I've come to understand it, it was essentially a push back against the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement of the mid-20th century. So I've had to wrestle with why did that happen and what did that have to do with racism in this country? What did it have to do with the way faith gets manipulated and misused? I was 17 years old, just off the fall of my junior year in high school, where I had paged in the U.S. Senate for Senator Strom Thurmond. He was a segregationist who never gave up his commitment to white supremacy. Yeah, in many ways, working for him was what helped me to see how the religious right had used Christian faith to line up communities like mine with a white voting coalition that didn't think of itself as voting based on race, but as voting based on our faith. Racism has always been perpetuated. White supremacy has been perpetuated in this country by convincing white people that it's actually good, not just for them, but for black and brown people.
Yeah.
Racism is establishing a system that treats people unequally and arguing that it's actually the best system possible and that, in fact, God blesses that system and wants it to continue. Reverend Barber came to my very white community and explained to me and to the community I was part of that that racism had been used against us, that systemic inequality has been used to prop up a system where a pretty small minority of the people have always had most of the wealth. But these demonizing and criminalizing narratives that pretend that, you know, some people made in the image of God are not like other people made in the image of God, you know, that there's some sort of fundamental difference, that is the lie that's been used to prop up a system that's incredibly unequal, and that I think ultimately God's justice demands that we challenge and transform. Well, I went to Eastern because I had met Tony Campolo, and Tony was representative of an evangelical tradition that had not accepted what I take to really be a false dichotomy between, you know, a personal relationship with Jesus and work for justice in the world.
So where we left off part one of the conversation, Jonathan was studying at Eastern University. In addition to being influenced by Tony Campolo, Jonathan also is going to encounter a group of fellow students and alumni from Eastern in Philadelphia during his time studying there at an intentional Christian community called The Simple Way. And that is where our conversation is going to pick up. I hope you enjoy part two of my conversation with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. So talk about The Simple Way and how you got connected to The Simple Way. And that's where you met Shane.
That's right. So that was a community of people who had just graduated from Eastern, Shane Claiborne being one of them, who had just moved into a neighborhood together. And very much, you know, in this tradition that Eastern represents, a tradition of people trying to take their faith seriously in terms of the practice of everyday living and take the call of justice and concern for the poor and the marginalized seriously, that the Simple Way was established as an intentional community, as what we've come to call a new monastic community there on the north side of Philadelphia. And yeah, we actually, that's why Leah had gone to Eastern. She had heard about what they were doing and wanted to be close to that and be part of it. And she introduced me to them, and we were very much learning from them and alongside them as we went through our education there at Eastern.
I guess it was 2007, maybe. CCDA conference was in Philadelphia, and some folks from Reba Place, we went and stayed at, I think we stayed at the Camden House in New Jersey, but there was an event at The Simple Way. I think you and I connected there. That was one of the times that I stole some of your time and picked your brain a little bit, because I think Greta and I were discerning whether to stay at Reba, just asking a lot of questions and trying to get guidance about, do we turn to the right or to the left? And that passage from Isaiah was kind of our theme. Whether you turn to the right or to the left, either way, you'll hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. So Simple Way, intentional Christian community, that's kind of like a $5 word that some people are like, I don't understand what that means. How do you describe, because Rupa, you could describe as sort of a Christian community as well.
Yeah.
So can you define that for people who are like, I don't know what that is?
Well, it's been here, and I think in most places, it's been an attempt for people based on their shared faith commitment to come to a pattern and a practice of a way of life together that allows them to support one another in practicing our faith day to day. So it's about praying together. It's about eating together. It's about meeting together and talking about, you know, how we're going to share money and property and how we respond to needs in our neighborhood and in our city. It's kind of, well, the reason we came to the language of a new monasticism was because we looked at the long history of the church and realized that there have always been communities of people who've tried to figure out how do you live the gospel day to day together. And that's taken different forms at different times, but those communities have often been called monastic communities in the church. And so we started learning from some of those traditions and trying to adopt what seemed to be, you know, common and helpful practices over time. from that tradition.
Or as the in Catholic language, a rule, right? Like a spiritual rule of life to give you, here's how you should live. These are the daily practices or the rhythms that you, you know, if you want to follow Jesus, here's what that looks like.
That's right. And, you know, again, that's kind of a church specific language, but if you, you know, a program might be best. Everybody looks for a rule of life. Some people look on the rack at the grocery store on the way out, you know, six easy steps to, you know, get in shape or have a better sex life or, you know, whatever it is they're advertising that week.
We all have a rule for life, right? It's just a matter of how intentional yours is.
That's right. That's right. So there's always people offering rules. I just think it's or programs for how we live. And I think it's important to recognize that the church has those too. And some things over time, I mean, you know, we Christians have tried all kinds of things. Some of them quite crazy, frankly. I mean, you know, there are people that lived on the top of poles by themselves to practice prayer. That's sort of a strange one. So yeah, there are all kinds of things that have been tried, but I think there's some common practices that have stood the test of time that are worth really leaning into. And that's one of the things I appreciate so much about the rule of Saint Benedict. Several years ago, I did a contemporary paraphrase of that rule in English. And as part of that project, I had a chance to go over to Italy and kind of retrace the steps of Benedict's life, you know, where he grew up and he went to Rome. And then it's interesting. Benedict's life's fascinating. He went to Rome at precisely the moment when Roman society was beginning to fall apart. And one of the things that's so interesting to me about his life is that, you know, his daddy had been the mayor of the town he grew up in. It's called Norcia, and wanted, you know, to get the best education for his son. He wanted his son to, you know, be like him and, you know, grow up and be an influential person in Roman society. So Benedict gets sent to the university in Rome and drops out, not because, like, you know, many college dropouts, he's, you know, too interested in parties or chasing girls or whatever, but he drops out because he realizes that he's in a formation program for a system that's falling apart. And he decides that he needs to be formed in a way that will allow him to imagine a new world. And so he goes up and lives in a cave above the lake outside of Rome. It's a place called Subiaco. And in that cave, he reads the Psalms and he reads the desert tradition. He reads the rules of, you know, monastics who've gone before him. And he begins to imagine that small groups of people intentionally trying to live the way of the gospel together can imagine a new way of being in the world. And that's the birth of the Benedictine movement, really the birth of Western monasticism is out of that experience. So
that imagination is a key piece. You have to kind of imagine there is a way of living in this world that isn't just kind of going along with the predominant culture. And then the other word that, you know, I thought of as you were talking is like an alternative. You said like some of these people would be perceived by others as sort of crazy. Well, I mean, going back to Jesus's time, the first disciples were thought to be very crazy because they were so countercultural.
Right.
In your experience, talk a little bit about some of the practices that you all follow at Rupa House. And it's not that you're trying to be countercultural. It's that this is your understanding of what it means to be faithful to Jesus. They just happen to go counter to American culture. What are some of the things that is, if it's just a normal American said, well, what do you do at Rupa House? What are some of those imaginative, alternative sort of things that rub up against American culture that you all do?
Well, I think the thing that's consistently been most surprising, both to neighbors and to, you know, folks who come along, meet us, is as a hospitality house that we've tried to have an open door to welcome every guest as if the guest were Christ. And so, you know, we often have a dinner table where folks off the street, folks from the neighborhood, people who look different, speak different languages, come from very different walks of life, sit down and eat together. And, you know, that's fluctuated over the years. It's all often depends on relationships and who's here, but it, you know, it's been a beautiful place to learn, you know, to sit at a table where someone who's homeless, you know, is literally across from a business executive. And, what do you talk about, you know, after you say, could you pass the potatoes and, you know, how was your day? It's interesting to see what happens when these, different lanes that we live in and that, you know, we often have a lot of assumptions about the people who are in the other lanes, the people we pass, but, you know, rarely talk to. And I feel like our dinner table here has been a place to pause and to consider, you know, what it means for us to all be, at the very least, part of the same human family, and in many cases, you know, part of the same family of faith.
Yeah, it seems to be a very basic tenet of American Christianity that everyone agrees with. Hospitality, you know, we should be welcoming. It's just different people have different definitions of what that welcoming might look like. And when we first, you know, graduated from Milligan and ended up in Chicago at Reba Place, that's again where I was doing a lot of unlearning and relearning. And we, my wife and I, had a homeless man who we invited to stay with us for the night. And I remember when my parents found out about that they were just, hi mom, if you're listening, but they thought, you know, we were going to this Reba Place church, which they knew was kind of weird. These people shared money and housing, and they thought it was a cult. And they kind of thought we were going off the deep end and doing dangerous things by opening our home to somebody we did not know. And how could I, as a young husband, put my wife, you know, in harm's way?
Yeah.
So I was having to confront, like, am I being irresponsible? You know, and it just, how do you live out that value of hospitality in a way that, you know, obviously if Greta and I weren't on the same page about that, it's not like I would have invited somebody in that she wasn't comfortable with. So we were on the same page.
One of the things that's most interesting about it is how it reveals to us, you know, what dangers or potential dangers we pay attention to. You know, we think it's dangerous to welcome and share with someone we don't know, or particularly someone who's in obvious need. That's very much a fear that's been cultivated in our culture. But I remember when we were in Iraq at the beginning of the Gulf War with the peace team, and we actually got kicked out of the country and had to leave in the middle of the war when the bombing was going on. And I remember there was this particular town. It's the town that our house here is named after, called Rutba, that when our car that we were in had an accident and a few folks with us were seriously injured, they took care of them in this town called Rutba and saved their lives. It was really incredible hospitality. And, you know, this was Muslim hospitality. These are, you know, Muslim people in Iraq, in the desert.
While the United States is bombing their country.
While the U.S. Actually, 3 days after the U.S. had bombed their hospital, they offered medical care to our friends. But it was chaos. And, you know, we thanked them and were very moved by the experience, ended up naming this house after them. And anyway, some years later, the group of folks who were injured there went back. And when they went back, they met some of the people who had helped them. And they told them how inspiring their hospitality had been to us. They told them about the Rutba house. They told them they'd told the story over and over. And what was striking was the people they talked to said, we didn't think we were doing anything unusual. They said, actually, that's the law. And they wanted to make sure they got it right, you know, in translation. They said, what do you mean it's the law? They said, well, it's the law of the desert. They said, if you live in the desert, you know that someone who is in need, you know, who you come across or who comes across your way, you know, particularly if they're thirsty or hungry, they could die before they get to someone else. So it's very dangerous in the desert not to practice hospitality. And they said, we're taught to practice hospitality as the law. And it just struck me as, you know, that's a very different notion of what's dangerous, right? I mean, they were also thinking about a danger. There's a very, very real danger that that in an arid desert, if you don't offer at least, you know, food and water to somebody who's traveling, they could die. And an awareness of that danger and of our solidarity with one another, our basic you know, common humanity, has created a culture where people think it's necessary even to take care of, you know, citizens of the country that just bombed your hospital. So a lot of times living across the divides and the barriers that, you know, have been written onto us, I think helps to expose the assumptions that we carry with us, sometimes without knowing it.
The most frequent command in Christian scripture, the most frequent thing God tells us to do is fear not, do not be afraid. And yet it seems that's the thing that we just have the hardest. Maybe that's why it said so much. Yeah. We just have a really hard time not being afraid of other people who don't look like us. We're just awfully afraid a lot of different things. And a lot of that fear drives us to be selfish and mm-hmm. hoard things or violent or, you know, all sorts of things as we kind of reflect on human history. And so, yeah, I mean, I just think about that a lot. If I could just work on that part, I would probably become a better person and a more faithful Christian if I just feared a lot less.
Well, and you know, fear is a powerful thing, which is why it's so often used, particularly by, you know, people in power to try to control us and, you know, get people to stay in line. And I think that's part of what the angels, you know, the messengers of God recognize, is that it's appropriate at a certain level and in a certain way to fear God. Right. The Bible also says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of understanding. But, you know, Jesus says that perfect love drives out fear. And so I think that the understanding that we can be, you know, in humility, we can submit ourselves to a way and to a person in Jesus who can demonstrate what love looks like in the middle of genuinely scary situations. Mm-hmm. I think that's what the journey of faith is about. And so it's, you know, for me, it's not so much about, you know, acting like we shouldn't be afraid. There's lots of things we should be afraid of. They're concerning. They're terrifying. And yet Jesus meets us in the midst of those things. And I think offers us a love that makes it possible to move forward together, even in, you know, in the midst of our fear, and that love can drive out fear. We can, to the extent that fear is a sort of response that wells up within us that either makes us freeze or run away, love can come and move us beyond that place to something much better.
You and Leah, the two of you as a young married couple, then moved to Durham and put down roots in a predominantly African-American community, Walltown, and have attended a predominantly Black church. Reflecting back on your early experiences of Reverend Barber coming into your community, and your church and his church started doing some stuff together, right? Back in those...
Oh, yeah. My home church, the all-white church I had grown up in, did... Yeah, quite a bit of sharing with one another in fellowship and in worship and in joint mission.
Did you think at that time, if we can just spend time together, like we'll break down some of these barriers? Or what was your hope?
I think it was largely driven by the hopes of the pastor of the church at that time, who, yes, I think was thinking along those lines, that it was an opportunity to live as family, sisters and brothers in Christ, across a dividing line. It turned out that a few things. One is that there was quite a distance between our churches, so it wasn't like they were our neighbors down the road. It was a good 3-hour drive. And in addition to that, that particular pastor moved to another place, and it turns out that many of the assumptions we have about what's good and right in the world and how we ought to live our lives and how we ought to cast our votes and how we ought to spend our money, a lot of that stuff it runs deep, and it's tied up with our daily habits. Mm-hmm. And I think those habits turned out to be hard to interrupt for most people in that mm-hmm. in that congregation and in that community.
So that sort of proximity piece, it was difficult for two congregations 3 hours apart to really build transformative relationships because distance was an obstacle. You already talked about intentional Christian community, that proximity of sharing housing, sharing money. I certainly saw the benefits of that at Reba Place. We were able to do a lot more ministry and be more impactful because we were all there together sharing space, and there was less obstacles. We weren't all in our homes doing our daily lives saying, oh, I'm too busy to do, you know, like the rhythms of life were intentional because proximity really helped with that. Mm-hmm. So you intentionally moved into this predominantly Black neighborhood and attended a predominantly Black church and have been there now for 15 years?
Oh, about 18 now.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's where the Rupa house is at. Are there things that you think now that you say, okay, like these are some things that I've learned, you know, from living in a predominantly Black community, going to a predominantly Black church that I feel like are general rules that could be helpful to as other American Christians think about racism and how to confront that? Like, is there a posture, lessons that white Christians should be thinking about as they think about what we should be doing to address things like systemic racism and in the church and in our country?
Well, our life has been a gift and has invited me into all kinds of relationships and settings that have helped me reimagine things. But I don't think that it's a template in any way or a program that would work for everyone or that would even be advisable for everyone. What I do think I've learned that when you ask the question of sort of what makes the difference, right? What allows people to not just encounter someone else, encounter, people who have been systemically marginalized by racism, but to take seriously the way that demands change of all of us. I think it's fundamentally about habits. What Professor Eddie Gloud at Princeton calls racial habits. A lot of what we talk about today as systemic racism, a lot of it is just what's normal, right? It's just the normal practice of the systems that we inherited. And part of the reason it continues, despite the violence, the real violence that people suffer, is because it feels normal to so many people who participate in it. And so I think finding ways to identify racial habits and interrupt them is the key, particularly for white people, to learning to see what's deeply wrong with the systems that we, you know, live in and participate in. And so, you know, that can be one racial habit that's very common in this in our society is, you know, despite desegregation and the end of, you know, the official end of Jim and Jane Crow and all of this, most people only have close friendships with people of the same race. Mm. And so one way of interrupting racial habits is to intentionally cultivate a friendship, which is about, you know, genuinely knowing and journeying with someone who doesn't share the same skin, and by virtue of not sharing the same skin tone, actually experiences the world that we're living in differently than somebody who, you know, looks like you and me. So that's just an example of, I think, how these, what you described, our life in this community, our life in this church, has allowed us to interrupt the racial habits of that we grew up with in white culture. And I don't think it has to look like this, but I do think that you do have to have those opportunities to be interrupted, because the thing about whiteness as an imagination, as a way of seeing the world, is that, you know, in and of itself, you can't think your way out of it, right? Because you can't, it creates a vision that doesn't allow you to see how other people experience the very same things that you experience. And so you have to be in some kind of relationship and setting where you can hear that directly from people. And I also would just say this, that's not like unimaginably difficult, because there are a lot of people, particularly right now in this country, there are a lot of people who are crying out about systemic racism and racial injustice. So it's not hard to hear folks, but we have to want to hear them, right? And so I think once people decide they want to attend to these things, and that might actually help them become better Christians and better human beings, then I think we can make intentional steps toward interrupting those racial habits.
One of the things that I've been reading is Ibram X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist. And he talks a lot about the role that policy plays, like to really change race in this country. It's not just enough to like get to know people. That I think you're exactly right. And he kind of points to, until racist policies are undone, though, we can do all the kind of hoping and relationship building. But a lot of this stuff is entrenched in our policies. You've been very engaged with the Poor People's Campaign, along with Reverend Barber. Mm-hmm. And that is a group of, well, tell us what that is and what those folks are calling for.
Well, let me say what you're saying from Brother Kendi is absolutely true, that so many of our racist ideas are simply used to reinforce systems. Mm-hmm. And so it makes perfect sense. And it's, I think, fundamentally true that we have to change systems in order to change ideas. The way the Poor People's Campaign has gone about trying to organize and mobilize people for that is by saying that those people who have been systemically marginalized in this society that we share, disproportionately Black and brown, but also poor white people, certainly our Native sisters and brothers, from whom so much of the land that we live on was either stolen or traded in, let's say, unequal terms. At any rate, to be in a movement that is led by people who are directly impacted by the injustices, but who are joining together and calling on everyone to work for a system that is more equal. That's what the Poor People's Campaign is about, and is about saying that actually it's a national call for moral revival, because you can't address these issues within the framework of left versus right, liberal versus conservative, the kind of political, tennis match that we're always living in. At some point, we have to get down to the moral issues that go below, that are more fundamental than our political ideologies, and that are really about that it's a fundamental question of right or wrong, whether we believe that the kind of inequality that exists and that has been perpetuated by this system should be challenged or not. And the Poor People's Campaign is fundamentally, as a moral issue, committed to challenging it.
And so it's not affiliated with any one party. It's not any one faith tradition. It's people That's of right. multiple faiths, or just people who feel like there's something wrong with the fact that we have a system with so many haves and have-nots.
Yes,
and there's a whole list of policy, suggestions or items.
About lifting up communities like those in East Tennessee. So I hope people will learn more about it. Poorpeoplescampaign.org.
Well, we will link to that. And I will also link to the School for Conversion website so people can find out about some of your writings and some of your books. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for all your good work over the years and your friendship.
Same here, brother. Good to be with you. Bless you.
Well, thanks so much to Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove for being my guest, for a great conversation in which he shared a little bit about his life and work and ministry at St. John's in the Walltown neighborhood of Durham, North Carolina, about some of his life experiences and some of the books he's written. If you have not checked out Jonathan's writing, I encourage you to do so. In the show notes, we will list a number of the different books that Jonathan has written. I will also link to The Simple Way, community that is in Philadelphia that we talked about during the episode, as well as the Christian Community Development Association, Camden House, Reba Place Church and Fellowship, where my wife and I attended in Chicago, the first place where Jonathan and I met. And again, I'm going to link to the Inspired podcast, a really good 55-minute interview in which Jonathan gets into some other conversation topics that we don't delve into in our conversation, but are really interesting parts of his journey and his story. And as we close out this episode, I am going to read to you a couple quotes from that conversation that Jonathan had on the Inspired podcast, because I think it really helps to frame the driving force of why he's engaged with the Poor People's Campaign and why he believes that's such an important initiative to be connected to. These are quotes from Jonathan in that conversation. I want to help white Christians recognize that a movement like the Poor People's Campaign is good news for us too, and we should be a part of it. I've come to feel that spreading good news is much more about participating in things that people understand to bless them than it is telling people a story that you think is good news for them. I'm a part of a campaign that believes that in order to shift the moral narrative in this country and the priorities in our public life for Democrats and Republicans, the voices of poor and marginalized people have to come to the center. So as you think about being engaged with your values, your faith convictions, whatever they happen to be, and beyond this election that's going to be taking place here on November 3rd, as you think about engaging with the world around you, with people who may have very different views than you, I hope that you will keep in mind some of those challenges that Jonathan has presented to us. Until next time, unleash your own generosity. And you ignite a flame inside our hearts, inside our eyes. But careful, careful as you lead us through the night. Keep us mindful of what's worthy of our many reasons why. And as you fix what's broken, don't forget what's right. As you fight the darkness, don't forget the light. As you fight